The most dangerous man ever arrested killed over 90 people across the Midwest with a light tap, his own clumsiness, and zero medical evidence.
And that's not just the sensational headline. That is the core of a case file that, frankly, shouldn't exist. It flies in the face of everything we know about forensics, about jurisprudence.
It really does.
When you dig into the evidence or the lack of it around this man, Benny Plunk, you're forced to look at something bizarre. His personal physical signature, just the way he moved, his presence, it was somehow operating as a weapon.
Yeah.
A completely undetectable one.
And that's our mission today. We're going to analyze this terrifying, just bizarre pattern. We have one central file on Benny Plunk, which covers his arrest back in 1967 in Akron, Ohio.
We also have something else, which is critical here. It's an index.
Right, an index. It's a cross-reference of other similarly strange, mostly redacted cases. Files that deal with people being systematically erased, impossible physics, hidden protocols.
Things that don't fit.
Exactly. And what we have to figure out is why Benny Plunk's story reads less like a police procedural and more like, I don't know, the operational log of some secret weapon test that just went completely off the rails.
It forces us, and you listening, to kind of redefine what violence even means.
Yeah.
Or homicide. We're not looking at a trained killer or someone using sophisticated poisons.
Yeah.
We're looking at a case where a man's most basic inherent traits, his politeness, his incredible clumsiness, somehow became this huge force multiplier for chaos.
So this deep dive is going to explore that thin, blurry line between deliberate violence and what this source material basically forces us to call weaponized happenstance.
A scenario where coincidence itself is lethal.
Okay, let's unpack this. We have to start at the beginning of the horror.
Let's do it.
So we begin with the man himself, Benny Plunk. He first pops up on the official record in 1967. He's arrested in Akron, Ohio, but it's the number attached to him that just stops you cold.
It's the scale. It's always the scale that breaks these cases open.
Authorities linked him, just through correlation, to over 90 accidental-looking deaths, all spread across a huge part of the Midwest.
And that staggering number is what just completely challenges the system. I mean, think about it. 90 deaths spread across, what, maybe half a dozen states?
Yeah, a huge region.
And every single one, individually, is filed away as an accident or, you know, natural causes. No single police department is tracking 90 deaths. It's not their case.
Oh, of course not.
It would have required some kind of federal or interstate task force, somebody looking for patterns that were, on a local level, just too mundane to even notice.
And the Midwest setting itself, it suggests he was moving around a lot.
Incredibly mobile, which is exactly how he could execute this.
Yeah.
This pattern across such a wide area without anyone in any one town putting the pieces together. Not until the data got aggregated years later.
What's really chilling, though, is the sheer monotonous repeatability of it all. The source material calls it the signature sequence. Investigators, once they finally connected all these disparate files, they found witnesses describing the exact same four-step series of events every single time.
And that repetition is crucial.
Yeah.
That's the whole key. It's what moves the case from just being a weird statistical anomaly.
Right.
You know, this one guy just has the worst luck and is always near someone dying.
Right.
And it turns it into a structured, defined, almost repeatable mechanism. That's why they started calling it the protocol.
Let's break down those four steps again, because they almost seem designed to be perfectly distracting.
They do. Okay, step one. Plunk approaches the person, always politely. It's in a casual setting, a coffee shop, a sidewalk.
Mm-hmm.
He just starts a harmless conversation.
Okay.
Step two, he taps them. Just a light, innocuous touch on the arm or the shoulder. Nothing aggressive.
Then step three, this is the misdirection.
This is the genius of it, if it was intentional. He immediately trips over his own feet. He'll stumble, maybe drop what he's carrying.
Yeah.
It frames him as just profoundly clumsy. All attention immediately goes to him.
To his apology, his flustered state.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And while everyone is looking at the clumsy guy on the floor, step four happens. The victim collapses instantly. Like they were struck by some massive instantaneous internal failure.
That tap, it seems way too casual to be the actual mechanism. It's not a punch, not a blow.
Not at all.
And the trip, it just perfectly frames him as the victim of his own little accident, which diverts all attention. If it was deliberate, it's a brilliant piece of stage magic. But the evidence suggests it was just him. That was his natural state.
And that impossibility is what drove the investigators mad. because there were no physical clues left behind. Absolutely none.
That's the core of the problem for any kind of law enforcement or, you know, medical examiner. The complete and total absence of forensic evidence.
No weapons were ever found because, well, it seems none were used.
No defensive wounds, no blunt force trauma, no toxicology reports showing poison. The victims just fell down.
As if their body just suddenly switched off. A massive unheralded cardiac event. An aneurysm, a stroke that happens in a split second.
From a legal perspective, you can't do anything with that without a clear mechanism of injury, a traceable cause of death. Classifying these as homicides was basically impossible.
It's the perfect crime, in a way. The action performed by the supposed perpetrator is completely indistinguishable from just a random natural event.
The medical examiner can always just fall back on some existing, you know, if rare, physiological explanation.
Of course. But you have to imagine the sheer crushing weight of coincidence required for 90 random people to just suddenly drop dead in the vicinity of one specific clumsy man.
Yeah.
That strain on statistical credulity, that's what finally led to his arrest.
And this brings us to this really crucial, singular piece of medical documentation we have. The file really emphasizes this. There was one and only one autopsy report that was ever finalized.
Think about what that means. The fact that only one out of over 90 deaths got a finalized, conclusive report tells you that the medical system basically just tiffed. It experienced a rapid, systemic failure when it came up against these cases.
They must have just been declaring the rest unsolved or defaulting to natural causes to just get them off the books.
That one autopsy report, it becomes the true artifact of this whole investigation. And the contents, well, they were mostly what you'd expect. Procedural, documenting normal findings, failing to identify any external cause of death.
But the source highlights two extraordinary things, two inclusions that suggest a deep internal conflict within the medical establishment. It's like the pathologist was cracking under the strain of the inexplicable.
The first one is minor, but it's so bizarre. A small, unexplained drawing just tucked away in the corner of the report.
A drawing.
A drawing. When you find something like that in an official clinical document, something extraneous, non-standard, like a non-verbal scream, it suggests the examiner saw something so unsettling or anomalous they couldn't even articulate it in accepted medical terms.
So what was it? Do we know?
We don't. Was it a diagram of some strange internal anomaly they couldn't name? Was it just a stress doodle that somehow captured the chaotic nature of the victim's collapse? We can only guess. But it serves as this silent marker of confusion in a document that's supposed to be all about certainty.
And the second thing is even more direct. The handwritten note.
Something went wrong.
Wow.
That note is monumental. It's the system admitting failure in real time, right there in permanent ink. It's an admission that the official conclusion, which was likely forced to be natural causes because of the lack of evidence, was a lie.
A lie of omission.
A lie necessitated by the limits of their science. The medical examiner knew viscerally, professionally, that a critical system failure had occurred in this person, but they couldn't assign a mechanism. They couldn't find a cause or a weapon. That phrase, something went wrong, is the definitive statement that Benny Plunk existed outside the known rules of physics and biology.
And yet, despite this alarming personal admission of just profound failure, the report was officially signed and approved.
And that's the final piece of the puzzle. The official sign-off, especially next to that note of failure, it suggests a deliberate, bureaucratic covering of the truth, which is that they didn't know the cause of death.
So they just closed the case.
Once that report was signed, the state legally erased the possibility of foul play.
Oh.
At least officially. This is so critical because it shows Plunk's influence wasn't just physical. It was bureaucratic. The system itself, the MEs, the police, the admin, was forced to agree to a falsehood. They had to classify a mass of killings as coincidence because the truth was functionally impossible to document.
The legal mechanism was weaponized against itself.
By the simple, clumsy reality of Benny Plunk.
So, on the strength of all this witness correlation and maybe just the sheer statistical improbability of it all, Plunk is finally arrested in 1967. They put him in a conventional prison. They think, okay, we've contained a physical threat.
Right, problem solved.
But within days, the danger he posed, it escalated immediately, right there in containment. This is that, oh no, turn in the story.
It is. Because a prison is designed to handle physical threats. You know, escape artists, violent criminals, people who break walls and heads. But they didn't capture a person like that. They captured a chaotic anomaly whose danger wasn't fixed.
It wasn't static.
Exactly. And the source material details this one moment where their entire investigative framework just collapsed. It proved that the danger was inherent to him, not something he did procedurally. The original protocol, it relied on those four steps.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The tap, the trip.
That was the observable pattern they'd used to build the case against him.
But during his very first week in prison, that reliance on the sequence just, it vanished. The incident involved two prison guards in a hallway.
And this is the pivot point.
It is.
Yeah.
Plunk merely waved at the guards.
Just waved.
Just waved. Now, I stopped to think about that for a second. This completely bypasses the whole clumsy signature sequence. There's no polite approach, no contact tap, and crucially, no self-inflicted stumble to divert attention. It was just a common social gesture, an acknowledgement from a distance.
And the result?
Instantaneous and identical. Both guards fainted. Collapsed right where they stood.
So, if he didn't have to tap or trip, what does the wave even tell us about the mechanism? Is this effect contagious now? Is distance irrelevant?
That's the question the prison authorities must have been just scrambling to answer. The wave suggests the weapon isn't dependent on a physical procedure. It might be about proximity or perception, or maybe even just recognition.
It implies his influence could be transmitted through the air across a distance just by being seen.
It transforms him from a clever killer who uses distraction into a fundamental phenomenon of physics. He is a human glitch whose mere presence disrupts human physiology. If a wave can do it, could a shared glance, could hearing his voice down a hall.
That raises the stakes monumentally. They arrested a criminal, but they realized they had contained something closer to a localized reality distortion field. His danger is inherent, not something he controls or deploys.
Precisely. The whole containment strategy was based on the assumption that they could neutralize the threat by stopping him from doing the four-step sequence.
But the wave incident just shattered that assumption in less than a week.
It suggests that Benny Plunk didn't cause bad luck. He was a source field of bad luck. And that influence was so much more pervasive and easily transmitted than they could have possibly imagined.
The security response, as the file knows, was swift and absolute.
Yes.
They were acknowledging this mysterious danger, even without understanding it.
He was immediately placed in isolation, solitary confinement, which is usually for neutralizing a threat, you know, by removing their ability to interact with other people.
But this was different.
Here, it was deployed explicitly to protect the staff and the facility from the prisoner, not just to contain a person. Locking him up alone was this tacit admission that they had zero idea what his range was, what the mechanism of action was, only that any interaction with him led to sudden, inexplicable incapacitation.
They weren't containing a man anymore.
They were trying to isolate chaos itself.
So he is in solitary, the ultimate secure environment, you'd think. And yet, just 2 days later, that chaos field just reasserts itself. Plunk escapes.
And this is where the story pivots from a medical mystery into something that sounds like, well, like impossible physics. His first escape, what the file basically describes as the hyperaccident, it wasn't achieved by force.
The containment system was physically sound.
Totally sound. No doors broken, no bars cut, no guards were overpowered. Nothing like that.
So the investigator's official conclusion, and you have to just imagine the bureaucracy involved in signing off on this, was that he slipped on a wet floor.
That conclusion is just a masterpiece of bureaucratic desperation, isn't it? A wet floor is a maintenance issue. It's a minor liability. It is absolutely not a mechanism for escaping a maximum security isolation cell.
No.
But the sequence of events that followed that initial slip, it reads like reality itself was just temporarily suspended to make sure Benny Plunk was free.
Okay, detail the path for us, because this is where that unbelievable chain reaction really starts.
The file records that the slip caused Plunk to fall directly down a laundry chute. Wrong. An immediate catastrophic misdirection for the prison.
Okay, that's unlikely, but maybe possible.
From there, he apparently bounced through three separate moving laundry carts. They were being staged for transport. It's like they were positioned perfectly to catch him, one after the other. He then exited the building, completely concealed, inside a rolling linen pile that was being wheeled out the gate.
That is not an accident. That is a perfectly orchestrated Rube Goldberg machine of improbable good fortune that only applies to one person.
The energy, the trajectory, the sheer statistical improbability of falling through multiple barriers and then exiting neatly packaged inside a decoy object. It implies that his influence went beyond just incapacitating people.
It suggests a localized, temporary distortion of causality.
Right, where every single thing that could go wrong for the prison system did go wrong, in a chain reaction that only worked out perfectly for him. His clumsiness wasn't a flaw. It was the trigger for an overwhelming cascade of favorable coincidences.
So some poor investigator had to write a report explaining that a prisoner left solitary confinement by taking an accidental multi-stage laundry ride to freedom. I wonder if anyone resigned over that.
It speaks to the desperation to just maintain some semblance of institutional integrity. Filing it as a wet floor clip is the system protecting itself from the truth.
Which is what?
That physics literally bent to allow his exit. They couldn't admit they were defeated by a bounce, a roll, and a pile of sheets. It was easier to blame a leaky pipe than to blame the chaotic nature of the man they were trying to hold.
And despite this, I mean, miraculous display of weaponized chance, his recapture 67 days later was just bizarrely anticlimactic.
Almost comically so. He was recaptured because he accidentally joined a prison tour group.
You're kidding!
Think of the irony. He successfully evaded a massive manhunt for months, using this sophisticated, undetectable form of chaos, only to just blunder his way back into the very facility he'd just escaped from.
He wasn't tracked down by surveillance or detective work.
No, he just walked back in. A simple social blunder, a moment of not paying attention.
And the specific cause of his discovery, the thing that gave him away, was that he was clapping too hard.
And analyzing that phrase is essential to understanding him. Clapping too hard. It suggests a minor disruption, an overzealous movement that drew attention in a place where he needed to be invisible.
So even a simple celebratory action
created enough of a minor uncontrollable disturbance to expose him. Maybe it was a loud clap in a quiet hall. Maybe he startled a tour guide. Who knows? But his very essence is chaos. Even when he's trying to fit in, his chaotic field gives him away. He's constantly generating this low-level friction with reality.
So they have him back in custody. This time, they put him in a reinforced cell. They're taking no chances, escalating the physical security to its absolute limit. And the final twist, his definitive erasure, is set up a few years later in 1974.
They contained him with steel, concrete, hypervigilance, matching the physical security to the existential threat he represented. But in 1974, the containment failed for good. The entire prison was evacuated.
And the cause they listed. A series of minor incidents occurred simultaneously.
This is the final act of weaponized happenstance, the complete collapse of institutional control. It wasn't one wet floor this time. It was a perfect, coordinated distraction created by multiple minor accidental events.
You have to wonder what those were.
We can speculate. A pipe bursts in the basement, a circuit shorts in the control room, a false fire alarm goes off because of faulty wiring, a massive traffic accident snarls the road outside the main gate.
Any one of those is manageable.
Exactly. But all of them at once, it creates systemic overload.
That synchronization is the key.
It's a perfect storm of low-level catastrophe, all happening at the exact moment required to force an evacuation. Plunk didn't need a key or a bomb. He just needed synchronized inconvenience. He proved that if you cause enough simultaneous failures in the mundane operation of a system, the system collapses, it evacuates, and it gives you a clear path out.
And the result of this hard landing twist, Benny Plunk was never found. He just achieved total erasure.
His final, most successful escape wasn't through violence or planning, but by orchestrating this overwhelming, non-forceful cascade of minor, uncontrollable coincidences. He forced the entire infrastructure designed to contain him to just empty out, leaving him to walk away. He achieved complete personal deletion by weaponizing the small, everyday failures of the system itself.
And we have to now zoom out from just the Benny Plunk file. We have to connect his story, this prisoner whose accidents became a weapon, to the broader context we have from the Inspector Story podcast series Index.
Right. This index is basically a documented catalog of impossible files. Its existence tells us Plunk isn't a one-off. He's not unique.
He's a documented recurring type of anomaly. He's an entry in a long index of events and people that are just too strange to be processed by normal government or legal channels.
So the index is the system's own internal acknowledgement that reality doesn't always play by the rules it sets for itself. The officials dealing with Plunk, they had a context for him, even if they couldn't explain him to the public. And we can see the parallels. We can categorize them into two major themes that pop up again and again in the index. Erasure and control systems.
Okay, let's start with theme one, erasure and hidden agendas. Plunk's final vanishing act in 74 is a complete personal deletion. He just ceases to exist in the official system without a trace of violence. And this echoes several other really disturbing entries in that index.
Take the file on Klaus Richter, known in the files as Der Schatten the Shadow.
An erased soldier from the S-87 bunker.
Right. The theme there is systematic deletion, war myths, black ops, erasure that's achieved through controlled, intentional effort by state actors. Plunk's erasure is achieved through spontaneous chaos, while Richter's is through controlled operations, but the end result is the same. The individual becomes impossible to account for.
So Plunk proved that absolute erasure can be achieved accidentally.
Or what looks like accidentally. It makes you wonder, Richter used the resources of a state, but maybe Plunk used the statistical laws of the universe to get to the same place.
There's another comparison, the file referenced as Luke Skywalker or Luang Saimong.
An orphan in Southeast Asia, described as carrying a humming blade, who just vanishes. And this isn't about the fictional character, obviously, but a file that's been named after that concept.
How does an orphan with a humming blade connect to a clumsy man who can't stop tripping over his own feet?
Because that file deals with erasure alongside forbidden, self-contained technology. The humming blade is a technology that defies normal engineering. In Plunk's case, he is the forbidden tech.
He's the anomaly.
He is. He vanished, but his tech, his capacity for accidental lethal influence, that remained embedded in the system as a cautionary tale. He taught the system that some things just cannot be contained. The index suggests that the presence of an inexplicable power, whether it's a blade or a human, is inherently linked to ultimate erasure.
So he's not just a person in these files. He's categorized alongside high-level black ops ghosts and forbidden self-operating devices.
Exactly. And one more under this theme, the file for Real Wendy from the Peter Pan file, an asylum case of a child who never ages past 13. The theme there is arrested time, erasure through medical and institutional bureaucracy.
Plunk's case feels like that. It's a record that's frozen in time by the sheer impossibility of explaining it, medically or legally.
They couldn't categorize the cause of death, so the investigation just... it stopped. It ceased to age or progress past that one point of admission. Something went wrong.
The comparison is chilling.
The system stopped trying to categorize him and just contained him until the sister itself broke. The Real Wendy file documents a failure to manage an entity that violates chronological rules. Plunk's file documents a failure to manage an entity that violates statistical rules. And in both cases, the subject gets permanently filed away under unsolvable.
Okay, let's pivot to theme two. Control, systems, and false games. These are the files that explore how the rules of reality seem to be manipulated, a lot like Plunk's weaponized physics.
The Monopoly, the collector file, is maybe the most esoteric one, but it's a necessary comparison. It's about a basement board game that, according to the file, teaches dead and perpetual obedience. The theme is a false game.
We're talking about governance by enforced, simplified rules. How does Benny Plunk fit into the idea of a false game?
Because Benny Plunk played a false game with reality, where he was the only player who, maybe subconsciously, understood the rules of failure. He knew how to harness the tiny, uncontrollable failures of the world, the wet floor, the simultaneous short circuit to achieve massive success.
Monopoly teaches you the rules of debt. Plunk's life taught the authorities the rules of chaos.
They used the system's own minor failures against it, which links directly to the Disney World Controlled Zone file. That one's all about governance and hidden protocols.
This is critical for understanding the kind of infrastructure that tried to contain him.
The Disney World file documents private rules, specific architectural loopholes like the 199-foot tower height to avoid FAA regulations, and these hidden protocols that govern a very specific hyper-controlled zone. The theme is simulation and proprietary governance.
Are you suggesting Plunk wasn't just a threat to law enforcement, but a threat to a governed reality?
Was he a glitch in a controlled zone? Was his chaotic field an organic counter-protocol to some established hidden system of control? The index suggests that absolute invisible control hides best in plain sight. And Plunk hides in plain sight by appearing clumsy and apologetic. Yet his chaos is so potent, it can only be compared to documented failures of controlled reality zones.
And the final comparison, the Aladdin or Adil al-Din file. It involves a ledger heist that grants power and then a scapegoat twist.
This highlights false fronts. Misdirection, bait. The question raised by that file, which we have to apply to Plunk, is was he the ultimate scapegoat, blamed for 90 deaths that could never be proven because they look natural?
Or was he the hidden power source, the essential anomaly?
The fact that his containment failed so spectacularly suggests he was the power source. He forced the system to collapse under the weight of his own minor failures. He wasn't the bait. He was the mechanism that sprung the trap on the entire prism.
Looking at the index as a whole, it's clear that the authorities, at some high level, saw Plunk not as a criminal, but as a violation of fundamental principles. They placed him alongside cosmic anomalies, and black op erasures.
He is categorized as a known type of impossible failure, which reinforces the idea that this is a recognized phenomenon, not just a one-off statistical fluke.
So we circle back to the profound core mystery of Benny Plunk. Did he somehow gain subconscious control over bad luck? Did he learn to manipulate the probability of minor events with his actions? Or was he himself a permanent walking phenomenon of physics, a localized field of uncontrollable coincidence that the world just reacted to lethally?
When you synthesize the two sources, the file and the index, it points heavily toward the latter. He was a documented existential phenomenon. The index confirms that figures like Benny Plunk are not random aberrations. They are documented types of anomalies, individuals whose very nature defies standard explanation, whose presence creates systematic failure and statistical collapse.
He wasn't trying to do anything.
He simply was a disruption.
It's just terrifying to think about the perfect crime being the source of chaos that, because of its inherent nature, can't be weaponized against him. Every time the system tried to define him or contain him, with medical reports, with reinforced cells, he used the system's own failure points to escape or just render the evidence useless.
He had this unparalleled mastery over the mundane. He didn't need to be strong or intelligent or even aware of his own power. He just lived, and the world accommodated his existence by failing around him. And the only piece of physical evidence that really matters, the permanent record of institutional defeat, is that handwritten note on the autopsy.
Something went wrong.
That's the system admitting defeat. Medical science, the bedrock of legal prosecution, couldn't categorize what happened. And that cemented the failure of the entire mechanism to understand him, let alone prosecute him.
Plunk didn't kill people in any traditional sense. He just seemed to trigger a cascade of natural failures that just happened to be in his favor.
That final image is just. It's of the prison emptying out in 1974, not because of a riot or a breach, but because the simultaneous minor incidents were just too much for the system's logistical framework to handle. That is a truly unique victory for a captive.
And it leads us to the final provocative thought we want to leave you with. What does it mean when the systems designed to contain chaos, the police, prisons, medical examiners, can be defeated entirely by simple, spontaneous bad luck?
It suggests that the boundary between controlled reality and uncontrollable probability is far thinner than we believe. And that some people, like Benny Plunk, simply exist on the other side of that line, forcing the world to rearrange itself around their failure.
If he wasn't planning the escapes, if he really was just that clumsy, then he was just living his life, and the world was rearranging itself lethally around him. That implication is profoundly chilling. It forces you to rethink the very concept of fate and coincidence.
Benny Plunk was arrested for causing accidents, but the terrifying truth is that every moment of his life may have been a controlled, lethal coincidence.